Hello, this is Russell Moore, and you're listening to Signposts. And this is where we gather together electronically to listen in on conversations that I like to have with thinkers and leaders that I admire and that we can learn from. And as we're doing this today, I want to remind you about the brand new podcast, that the Russell Moore podcast, that includes Bible teaching, questions and answers, and The Cross in the Jukebox, where we look at music through the prism of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And you can check that out wherever you listen to podcasts. But here on Signposts, this is the place where in conversation, we look for those pointers of God's grace, what Walker Percy called signposts in a strange land, and see where God is at work. And I'm really excited about this conversation today because my guest is Professor Mark Knoll, who is the Francis McEnany Professor Emeritus of History at the University of Notre Dame. He lives in Wheaton, Illinois. And any of you who are familiar with the discipline of history at all will be very familiar with the work of Mark Knoll. He's the author of too many books to even recount. I have just sitting here on my desk right now, America's God, From Jonathan Edwards to Abraham Lincoln, Turning Points, Decisive Moments in the History of Christianity, and a book that was a monumental influence on my life and thought, and was one of those books that I had to read really slowly because I kept going back and rereading sections over and over again. And that's The Scandal of the Evangelical Mind, which was the Christianity Today 1995 Book of the Year. Professor Knoll has a relatively new book that he's edited along with two other historical rock stars in the American historical world and British historical world, for that matter, David Bebbington and George Marsden, called Evangelicals: Who They Have Been, Are Now, and Could Be, which is a really important topic that I find myself asking often, and people are asking me often, whether they're believers or unbelievers. Professor Knoll, welcome to Signposts. Thanks for being here.
Well, thank you. It's really my treat to be with you.
This new book that you wrote, which is that you edited in continuity with other things that you've been writing for many years about what it means to be an evangelical. I have to admit that I'm a conflicted evangelical when it comes to the word. I found myself writing a piece a few years ago about why I hate the word evangelical now, because of the way that it's used when it can be applied to everything from prosperity gospel, televangelist, to political activist, to everything else. But on the other hand, Christianity Today and all of the various evangelical parachurch ministries were a lifeline to me and have been over the years. So I don't want to give that word up. And so I wonder if you sense that sort of conflicted nature of whether to be called evangelical or not.
Well, you've certainly put your finger on a contemporary issue of great interest, but then also, as you indicated, to historians, it's really an interesting issue. The book you referenced came out of conversations between George Marsden, David Bebbington, and myself. And we were, of course, concerned about the history of writing about evangelical Christians, but also aware of, as historians sometimes are, of what's happening right around us, a great deal of controversy related to the political understanding of the word evangelical. And it was trying to bring together those two things, which the book attempted, but bringing together those two things speaks exactly to the kind of confusion that you referenced in being influenced by evangelical, self-described evangelical groups, and yet having a great deal of uncertainty and a great deal of controversy in the present world. My own sense, and we tried to communicate this in the book, is that conceptually and historically considered, there really is not a whole lot of controversy. Evangelicalism or evangelical emphases are those that emphasize the Bible as the final authority, new life in Christ, the work of Christ on the cross is a key matter for salvation, very often a conversion experience, and then the kind of activity that evangelicals are renowned for in mission work and evangelization. With the contemporary politics and the identity politics that's associated with evangelicals as a strong component of the Republican Party, and supposedly 81% of white evangelicals, however defined, voted for Donald Trump in 2016. That's a different sort of issue. So we have what might be considered a historical question and a contemporary question. How do those two come together? That's what we try to do in the book. I don't know if you try to do more than one thing in a book, sometimes you don't get anything done, but hopefully we've been able to clarify some history and then say a few things about the present as well.
Well, one of the things that was interesting to me is when you're looking theologically in this book, I can't remember if this was in one of your essays or someone else's, but talking about how it can be murky, this definition, and the example was used of the NAE statement of faith on exclusivity of Christ and salvation up against maybe some of Billy Graham's comments earlier in his ministry. And so it can be, there can be some sort of borderlands here in terms of definition, can't there?
Well, certainly that's the case. And the specific incident you were referring to is the effort by the National Association of Evangelicals to come up with questions that can be used for responsible surveys. And one of the questions coming out of evangelical history is, salvation comes through Christ alone, true or false? Well, the evangelical answer is obviously true. But once or twice in Billy Graham's career, people ask him, well, is it necessary to believe in Christ to be redeemed? He, of course, would say, well, all who are redeemed by Christ, but is it necessary to be self-conscious about this? And Billy Graham said, I'm agnostic. So you could say that in some ways, Billy Graham, the best known figure in American evangelical history of the 20th century, was at least on some details of traditional evangelical Christianity a little bit ambiguous. And that is the kind of situation that just doesn't compute.
Isn't it true, though, when you talk about this issue of trying to find questions to ask in surveys, that that's part of the problem here? I mean, for instance, as somebody who lives in the so-called Bible Belt, I know very, very few people who actually would refer to themselves or think of themselves as evangelicals. They would just think of themselves as Christians or Methodists or Baptists or whatever they are. And yet it's a culture where even now, if someone calls in a survey and says, have you been born again? Well, the answer is going to be yes, because of everybody's been to vacation Bible school and everybody made a profession of faith at some point or other. So how could you actually discern what evangelicalism is and is not in terms of what people actually hold in practice?
That is an awfully good question. And to my thinking, there just is no simple answer. To the question, what is an evangelical or are you an evangelical? The proper response always should be, how are you defining evangelical? And depending on how evangelical is defined, then things can go in different directions. If you ask about the main characteristic, can even going beyond being born again, to trust in the Bible, to believing that the death of Christ on the cross is a key to Christian salvation, being active in Christian life, being interested in evangelization. A really good survey taken toward the end of the 1990s asked 3,000 Canadians, 3,000 Americans, questions like this. And in Canada, something like half of the people who showed up as the evangelical answers were Roman Catholic. Well, that's in the modern situation, that's not too surprising, but historically, the word evangelical was used to mean non-Catholic and even sometimes vigorously anti-Catholic. So you have a really difficult situation if you're asking about beliefs and then you put them into categories. Your reference to people who might have evangelical characteristics but would never think of calling themselves evangelicals reminds me of a situation where I was a visiting professor at Juniata College in Pennsylvania for a year in the early 1980s. I had a really earnest young man who was a student who in a class and came to me explaining his love for Christ, his devotion to the scriptures. And I asked him, now, would you consider yourself an evangelical Christian? He said, oh, no, I just believe the Bible. Yeah. So that was the kind of confusion that develops when different aspects of life and different perspectives on a common question are brought together. I don't think the confusion will ever cease until people are really clear what they mean when they use the word evangelical.
You mentioned Catholicism, and of course, you have taught extensively in majority Roman Catholic contexts. One of the things that tends to disturb some younger evangelicals, one of them was just asking me this question just a few weeks ago, is the famous John Henry Newman quote, "To be deep in history is to cease to be Protestant." And some evangelicals that I know who aren't swimming the Tiber to Rome, but who are deeply conflicted and afraid if they start tracing their way back in history, that they would, in fact, cease to be evangelical and cease to be Protestant. You're one of the most world-renowned historians of any kind alive, and also an evangelical Christian. What would you say to someone who's disturbed about those questions?
Yeah, I didn't realize that when I went to Notre Dame that part of my job description would be to talk to people of exactly the sort you've just described, that is, people who grew up basically in evangelical or sometimes fundamentalist households who were strongly attracted to Roman Catholicism because the Catholic Church has a sense of history, Catholic Church has a strong commitment to liturgy, a strong commitment to aesthetics, and these were things that were drawing some of these students in the direction of conversion. Some of them went on to become Catholic, some of them didn't. The message that I tried to communicate was just to be clear about what history gives you. In my view, the Catholic Church is actually very strong historically in areas where evangelical Protestants are weak. But a historical perspective can also show that there are areas in Catholic life and faith that are not as strong as areas of Christian life amongst evangelicals. So modern-day Catholics, I had many people at Notre Dame tell me, we Catholics need to learn from you evangelicals. Usually they said Protestants because it wasn't quite always clear in Catholic minds difference amongst Protestants. But what they were saying is you evangelicals nurture a personal relationship with Christ leading to personal activity in the service of Christ. That is something that we as Catholics need to do much better at. And I think that was a true statement. It's also the case that historically considered, the evangelical tradition, Protestant traditions more generally, have wonderful examples of serious intellectual life, serious engagement with history, serious liturgy, serious concern for aesthetics. I suppose you could say the quick answer for someone who says, I must become a Catholic in order to have some beauty, is say, well, you need to think about J.S. Bach. You need to think about Rembrandt, who wasn't actually a practicing Christian, but came out of the Dutch Protestant world. And that Dutch Protestant world was a really tremendous impact on his paintings. So the statement that you made, to be interested, to be deep into history, is to move toward Catholicism, is certainly true in some cases. But my sense is that a fuller grasp of historical reality still leaves open the questions. And the grass may be greener on the other side of the fence for some particulars. The grass may be green on your side of the fence that you just haven't noticed.
Yes, it does seem that some of the people that I have known who were Catholics and who became evangelicals expected that everybody in their new church communion would be pious and filled with the Spirit and deep in the Bible and were disappointed. And some people that I've known who have become Catholics thinking that I'm going to walk into a church full of Walker Percys and Flannery O'Connors and so forth have found also that they're in a situation where they deal with sinners and with all sorts of some of the same problems they had before. So sometimes I think our idealizations don't tend to turn out.
That's exactly right. I think it's just a normal human tendency to sometimes compare the best in another tradition with the worst in one's own tradition. That's not a clear way of making progress on these kind of questions.
Now, you talk about a little bit in one of your essays in this book, The Evangelicals, about the World Cup and the World Series. And I chuckled when I read your comment about Americans saying, well, why would you call it the World Cup if we're not involved? And others asking, well, why would you call it the World Series if only Americans are involved? With global evangelicalism, what do you see happening around the world? And do you see more of a connectedness with American evangelicalism or with the way that the world seems to be splintering up into various nationalisms and so forth? Is it going the other way?
Right. I mean, probably a much more important issue for the worldwide situation and for the general history of Christianity than whatever is happening with the word evangelical situation in the United States. We were really pleased to have contributors to the book that included Brian Stiller, who is a Pentecostal minister from Canada, but who is the one of the general secretaries of the World Evangelical Fellowship, writing on the viability of the term evangelical around the world. Now, Stiller is aware that evangelical movements, evangelical-type movements around the world are often not closely connected to each other, but he was really quite optimistic about the continuation and the expansion of evangelical-type Christianity in new places, China, Africa, many places of Latin America. The question from a historical point of view is not whether there are a burgeoning of evangelical-type groups around the world, many of them having very little to do with the United States, but it is the question whether these evangelical-type movements around the world continue on with the main evangelical influences coming from the Reformation and revived in the 18th century revivals. A particular question that is paramount is probably the issue, and you referred to it a little bit earlier, whether the kind of prosperity gospels that are not unknown in the United States, but proliferate around the world, whether they stand closely related or not so closely related to the historic Protestant, indeed Christian, emphasis upon the atonement, the death of Christ, the suffering of Christ, the cross of Christ as the way to God and the pathway to satisfying Christian life. Certainly, there's a continuity between the understanding of the gospel in many parts of the world and the missionary emphasis, for example, but some of them are kind of wild and woolly, and whether or not they will be, over time, drawn back more toward classical Christianity or not, I think is an open question. What is clear, however, and Brian Stiller and others who are conversant of the church around the world know, is that the American issues are important for the world, but they're not the world. And to think that what United States Christians of any sort are worried about in our situation dominates the world is just a simple mistake. The things that are happening around the world are very divergent. There's many different things. From an evangelical point of view, some of them are very positive. From an evangelical point of view, some of them are not so positive. But many of them have very little to do with the things that were so knotted up about in the United States.
Hmm. You know, one of the most moving experiences that I've had over the last year or so was being in London and speaking to a group of evangelical Christians there. And I just spent a few minutes talking about how indebted my life is to British Christians, such as C.S. Lewis and John Stott, J.I. Packer, people along those lines. And I'd been thinking about that the entire time there. And someone stood up at the end and said, everyone in this auditorium, if you became a Christian or you became a Christian through the witness of someone who became a Christian at a Billy Graham crusade, would you please stand up? And it was almost the entire auditorium. And it was just one of those moments where you just realize how the rippling of ministries can just go around the world without the people involved necessarily even being able to see them.
Well, that is certainly a valid reflection on many, many experiences. I'm privileged to be a friend of Grant Wacker, who's written a couple of really nice books on Billy Graham over the last several years. And his books have concentrated on Graham's work in the United States and questions that have risen about his ministry. Grant is actually very, very positive about Billy Graham. But he has said that the real impact of Billy Graham is almost certainly in the future going to be his work around the world. The Graham Organization, for example, was the major sponsor of the Lausanne Conference in 1974. And then of conferences in the Netherlands, drawing together evangelists from around mostly the non-Western world, the Third World, the Southern Hemisphere. And Grant's conclusions, I think, just cannot be questioned. Graham certainly was a major figure in the United States, but the way in which he promoted a Christian message and wasn't too particular about who picked it up and what they were called, but the promotion of that Christian message around the world, so many different places in so many different ways, would be his longest lasting legacy.
Would you agree with the people who would say, there are several people who have said in recent years that the idea of a new Great Awakening, similar to the revivals that happened with Billy Graham and others after the war, that's dependent upon a particular time in history, and specifically in American history, of post-war prosperity that's not likely to happen again? Would you agree with that?
Yes. Historically considered, definitely. The post-war era, when the National Association of Evangelicals got off the ground, when Billy Graham became an important figure, when groups that were separated in the United States, the Southern Baptists, the Missouri Synod Lutherans, the Pentecostals, really were in just very separate categories, very separate silos, began to have mutually beneficial contacts with each other. That was an unusual circumstance. The things that have happened politically in the United States since then have led to seriously divided subgroups. So it's very hard to imagine that there could be a kind of broad culture-wide revival of the sort that we've seen after the war and then in earlier periods, 1850s, 1740s. Nonetheless, as a Christian person and a historian who's a Christian, I've got to look back and say, well, you know, some of the wonderful things that happened in Christian history were completely unexpected. Some of the wonderful things that happened in Christian history, nobody could have predicted. Experts at the time were flabbergasted about them. So I think it's always important for believers to do their homework, to make the calculations that they think are best and most important, but to realize that we are not in charge and that the Lord's sovereignty over the universe means that his timing will determine major developments like major revivals.
And at the same time, as we're looking at this time of pandemic and potential global economic depression, there are some people, I think, who are counting on this time of difficulty bringing about that sort of revival. But we can't count on that, can we?
No, indeed not. And I think, again, this would be a historical perception that what has been the most effective God-honoring work from Christian believers of all sorts in the past has come from people not who are trying to calculate what their work will end up doing, but from people who are engaged in their work because they believe that's the call of the Lord to do the work for the honor of God and to leave to the Lord himself the outcome of their efforts.
Well, I mentioned at the beginning that I was really influenced early on by your book, The Scandal of the Evangelical Mind, and for multiple reasons, not just because of the argument there, but because it seemed as though there was someone out there who was articulating a problem that I could see, but I couldn't articulate. And I wonder, as you reflect on that now, I was thinking about the book this week when I was looking at, there were all of these conspiracy theories going around the social media about the pandemic being engineered by Bill Gates or a group of billionaires, and it's all a hoax. And I was sitting there looking at this saying, how could you believe this obviously conspiratorial nonsense here? And I wonder if in 2020, are you more optimistic or pessimistic about the state of the evangelical mind?
Well, the simple answer is both. So I guess that would be the historian answering. The situation to describe is new in the sense of new media. The internet, social media give an opportunity for ideas and proposals to just spread like wildfire. That's different than the past has been to some extent, but evangelical Christianity certainly in the English-speaking world and around the world more generally has always been a movement with a very strong popular or populist edge. And that populism has been wonderful in bringing the gospel into ordinary people's lives in ordinary ways, but it also has some problems. And one of the problems is the intellectual capacity to shoot before you've aimed and to be carried away with, as your illustration, sort of wild conspiracy theories. George Marsden makes a really nice point in the book we've been talking about on evangelicals, that if you have a very large constituency and only a really a small percentage of people who are trying not to follow this wild and woolly conspiratorial thinking, it may not look like a whole lot is happening. But in fact, George went on to argue that if you have 70 or 80 people who in some sense are evangelical Christians in the United States today, and 5% of them or 10% of them are relatively serious about what they're doing, relatively serious about trying to think things through, then you actually have a very significant number, even though the 90% get all the publicity, all of the attention, and all of the press. So I'm actually quite encouraged at the Christian study centers that now exist on many secular universities, at the strength of faculty in Christian colleges and universities and seminaries, in the really strong record of publication and biblical studies and serious work on Christianity and science. I mean, all of these things exist now with a strength that did not exist 40 and 50 years ago. We also have a lot more nonsense in the ether, a lot more viral postings that probably aren't worth a second's attention. So is this the best of times or is it the worst of times? And again, I have to say it's probably both.
What would you say to a young evangelical, and there are many of them, who are discouraged? And one of the reasons that they're discouraged is because they've been disappointed in seeing scandals, people that they admire, whether on the local level or the national level, or people who aren't, people they respected who aren't living consistent with their convictions. And so they're wondering, is this all just a marketing scheme? And they're tempted to walk away. I hear from a lot of people like that. What word would you have for them as someone who has looked at this over a long period of time?
Well, that's a good intellectual question. It's a good existential question, because those kind of situations just are present all the time. And now, particularly given the widespread publicity. First, I think you'd have to say, good for people to have a moral conscience that recognizes when others fall short. The second thing, though, I think I'd say is that the Christian faith has at its basis been a faith about grace and redemption and never about perfection. The Christian faith has stressed that people are redeemed, not because they do the right thing, but because God does the right thing for them. So that we shouldn't really be too surprised in ourselves and others if there are sins, if there are mistakes, if there are blunders. But then the third thing to say is that the Christian faith, besides being a faith of salvation by grace, is also a faith in which people's lives have been shaped and can be shaped by the grace that brought them into fellowship with God. So that even while we shouldn't be surprised when leaders fall, when we ourselves disappoint ourselves by our sinful behavior, we should also be encouraged that the gospel message itself has a kind of propulsive force, urging people to live up to what now they have become, the children of God, so that the proper understanding of the goals of sanctification and the realities of redemption hopefully can stay together and be an encouragement for people not to act in imitation of the errors of other people, but act in imitation of those, and there's many of these, believers who are living lives of faithful godliness.
Well, that's a good place to end on a note of good news. Mark Knoll, you are a hero to me, and I'm so grateful and thankful for your work and your scholarship and your life. Thanks for being with us today on Signposts.
Well, my privilege, and it's been an encouragement to speak with you, and I've admired your work for a very long time as well.
Thank you all for listening today. We encourage you to subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or Stitcher or Pocket Cast or wherever you listen, and to check out the new podcast there as well. Leave a review. It will help us to allow other people to find the show. And if you're listening on a smartphone, you can tap the cover art and you'll find some show notes, some resources, where to get Professor Knoll's books and other things. This is Russell Moore, and you're listening to Signposts.